Welcome to this edition of the Pepperdine People Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Gibson. This series captures some of the outstanding learning and outreach opportunities available here at Pepperdine. Each episode features interviews with exceptional members of our community and the special people who visit our campus.
My name is Tim Perrin, Vice Dean of Pepperdine University School of Law, and it's my great pleasure today to be with Ken Starr, Duane and Kelly Roberts Dean of the Law School, and Tom Stepanowicz, the William H. Webster Chair in Dispute Resolution and Managing Director of the Strauss Institute for Dispute Resolution, talking about their recent participation in the Qatar Law Forum in Doha, Qatar, regarding global commitment to the rule of law. And I'm wondering, Professor Stepanowicz, if you might give us some background on the forum and how you and Dean Starr came to participate in it.
Last year, I made my first visit to Qatar. There was a new arbitration center in Doha, and at that time, representatives from various countries were invited. I made connection with a young gentleman named Malik Dahlan, who is located primarily in London and who runs an organization called the Institution Quraysh, which is focused on, among other things, rule of law issues, and particularly as they relate to the state of Qatar. Malik met Dean Starr last summer, was thoroughly enchanted, as we all are, with Dean Starr, and extended an invitation to both of us to attend this year's conference, which was a much larger global conference addressing issues relating to the rule of law. So we were back in Doha.
I want to pick up on that theme. This forum was truly global in nature, with representatives of more than 60 countries, many chief justices of the country's courts, other high-ranking officials. Some people described it as the legal G20. I'm wondering, Dean Starr, what's the significance of this kind of global gathering to address shared commitment to the rule of law?
I think we need to begin by focusing on it from our host's perspective. Qatar has a very intriguing leadership, the emir and the ruling family, including the First Lady, if I may refer to Sheikh Samuma Moza as that, have a very progressive view of their stewardship responsibilities to the country. The country has a new constitution. But most relevantly, it is seeking to become a major financial center, at least in the Persian Gulf specifically, and the Middle East more generally. And so the Rule of Law Conference was directed toward the launch of a new court, the Civil and Commercial Court of Qatar, which is being held out with its very distinguished membership, which has a number of British justices and judges, including the retired Lord Chancellor of England, Lord Harry Wolfe, as members of the court. More generally, I think that what Qatar is doing is pointing to the need for all countries that are interested in economic and educational development to have, as part of the foundation, a rule of law regime, that if there is not confidence in the legal institutions in a particular country, then individuals and companies that might be eager to consider investment simply will not do so. But from that platform or foundation, we discuss much more generally broader issues of the global commitment to the rule of law and how to both articulate the vision of a rule of law across cultures, across languages, and a sense of shared values, hopefully, across national lines.
Dean Starr, you were part of a panel at the conference on the rule of law today, addressing four questions, including what's the state of the rule of law worldwide? I wonder if you might share with us reflections on that session, including your own remarks and the themes that arose out of that discussion.
I would say that our panel discussion ended up being much more aspirational than a articulation or a tour of the horizon. And at that session, It was wisely decided by our moderator, another retired Lord Chancellor, Lord Falconer, who we came to know lovingly as Charlie Falconer. Lord Falconer, who was, I believe, the last Lord Chancellor to given the transition that's underway, a position that was held for 1,400 years, embraced by the British for 1,400 years, had a wonderful idea that the members of the panel, and I was honored to be one of the panelists, should say as little as possible, but should be catalyst to spark a very lively conversation, because in the audience were such luminaries as the president of the World Court, the International Court of Justice, the president of the European Court of Human Rights. I could go on. Many judges from literally around the world. And so there was, in a sense, a brainstorming session as to what are the elements of a rule of law system. And we quickly moved the conversation to a conversation about or a focus not simply on legal structure and constitutional structure, but also developing a culture of rule of law. So not surprisingly, the conversation turned to education, the need for civic education, which I think, by the way, more relevantly for us here, is an issue that we might think, well, we have everything to teach and nothing to learn. But no lesser authority than Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who we were honored to have at Pepperdine this spring, has said, she didn't have occasion to say it here, but she said as recently as May of 2009, so very recently, she said, civic education, talking about the rule of law, in the United States has collapsed because of the collapse of the public educational system's focus on civic education, which is, of course, fundamental and foundational to the rule of law.
Powerful. Dean Starr, you were quoted as saying in relation to the conference, quote, I feel a statement of basic human rights standing alone is insufficient to achieve rule of law values. Can you elaborate on that comment?
Drawing from our own founding experience from over two centuries ago, the founding generation warned about reliance on paper and parchment values, that liberty has to lie in the heart of the people. But structural arrangements can, in fact, help ensure the rule of law. Why? So that we prevent too much power in at least our tradition, which is a tradition we share with so many countries around the world, which, of course, we inherited from the mother country, that much of the fight for human liberty and therefore for human rights has been the limitation and curbing of power, the concentration of power in the hands of one individual or one governmental entity and so forth, is something that is to be viewed with great caution. And so now to return to the conference, the Qatari experience is very interesting because its culture is centuries old. The Arab and Islamic cultures obviously have deep, deep roots, and those roots are being respected. And yet at the same time, the Qatari leadership, really led by the emir, is interested in what I would just call a limited democracy. So there are, in fact, now elections to an advisory council, and I'm very pleased to say, and one of the themes of the conference was the role of women in Qatari life and in the Arab and Muslim world more generally. Women not only have the right to vote, one might expect that, but it's not universal in the world, in all cultures. Moreover, women have the right to hold office in Qatar. So by their example in moving toward a limited democracy, even though it's an emirate and the emir is not elected, the emir serves for life. And the emir, and this is under the Constitution, then the emirship is determined by birthright. So it's very different, given its culture, given its traditions. But within that cultural constraint, there is a very, I think, sincere interest in how can we both respect the culture of Qatar, the Arab and Muslim culture, but at the same time, how can we expand the franchise, create a, what I call a limited democracy, but importantly for them, have financial institutions, which is where Tom Stepanowicz was very helpful a year and a half ago in terms of commercial arbitration, and then to have a court system so that if a matter does in fact need to be adjudicated in a more formal way, that there will be a court in which the parties have confidence in terms of professionalism and integrity.
Thank you. Professor Stepanowicz, you participated on a panel on the topic of international dispute resolution, including mediation and arbitration. And I wonder if you could give us a sense of the flavor of that session and your participation in it.
Well, I have to say we were very pleased that at a conference on rule of law, there would be an effort on top of everything else to actually devote time to alternatives to court trial. I think, frankly, both of those topics are, that is, arbitration and mediation, are increasingly coming to the fore in discussions among nationals of different states. And in the Arab region is no exception. As I mentioned earlier, a year ago, there was a conference surrounding the inauguration of the Doha Arbitration Center, which itself was one of a number of new initiatives in the region. It's all part and parcel of this evolution of Emirates in the Persian Gulf into the modern age and the commercial world as well as the broader world at large. The concept of binding arbitration has, of course, been given a lot of legs, significant life as an alternative to local courts through the mechanism of a convention, which provides for the enforcement of private agreements, including agreements between nation states and other entities, to arbitrate, which means private binding dispute resolution outside the courts. So in other words, your judge is a private arbitrator instead of a regular court. This has a number of advantages, and of course the most signal one in the international arena is that neither party is required to go into a foreign court system, except for the purpose of enforcing the agreement, and then if necessary, for the purpose of enforcing the award or decision that arbitrators make. So there has been a global discussion about the increasing role of arbitration in lubricating the global economy, in lending additional transparency and trustworthiness and confidence in international transactions. The reality, of course, is somewhat more difficult, and different arbitration provisions, different arbitration centers function in different ways and with different degrees of success. Two, one has to recognize that arbitration is not the same as the court system. And there's always this challenge of asking how the role of an arbitrator and the infusion of legal principles differs from the experience one would have in a court of law. The fact is that in modern arbitration, there is often a great deal of emphasis on legal principles. Major modern commercial arbitration, whether it's here in the United States or internationally, tends to be dominated by lawyers. The question is not, will law play a part, but which law? Which procedural law, which substantive law, with what twists will it be applied? There's an old story about chancery, where someone complained that if you went to the court of chancery, the kind of justice you got varied with the length of the chancellor's foot. And you sometimes hear complaints about arbitration that are similar. More and more, there are discussions about the role of law in arbitration. In the U.S., for example, there seems to be a trend in major transactions, particularly where there's a concern that you may have a bet the company dispute, to actually try to provide for additional judicial scrutiny of arbitration awards for errors of law. So right here in the United States, the debate over the rule of law continues to be a very important one and continues to evolve. In addition to arbitration, there is the growing use of mediation in commercial disputes. Again, the fact that we were talking about this in Doha, Qatar, was very interesting. Quite frankly, there is not a lot of what I would call modern mediation. That is, intervention by an experienced third party to try to help facilitate negotiation of commercial disputes. There's not a lot of that in the Persian Gulf region. I understand that in Dubai, the arbitration center there has begun to develop different applications of mediation. And yet, what I'll call modern mediation is still in its infancy in the region. So this is something that they're interested in learning more about. Now, in the United States, for the last generation, we've been experimenting with the use of mediation in a whole variety of different settings, community disputes, commercial disputes, personal injury issues. At Pepperdine Strauss Institute, we teach a very popular professional skills course called Mediating the Litigated Case. Tens of thousands of disputes are resolved every year in Los Angeles County through mediation. And it's an enormously effective tool. One of the reasons it is effective here in the United States is because there is the backdrop of the rule of law. Parties know that if things are not resolved at the negotiating table, there is a mechanism and a somewhat transparent mechanism which operates according to certain understood rules to resolve the conflict. Now, it may be more expensive than people like. It may be more time-consuming, and that in itself may stimulate resolution of conflict at the negotiating table. Nevertheless, the rule of law, that is, bargaining in the shadow of the courthouse, is an extremely important, some would say essential element of mediation as we know it in the United States. Now, when you talk about mediation internationally, which we were doing, it's a very different picture. First of all, mediation has not caught on in a modern sense in many countries of the world, even though there's a lot of discussion going on, and there are new mediation centers springing up everywhere, and universities providing programs on how to mediate. It happens that the countries in which mediation has been most successful are common law countries, like the U.S., Great Britain, former Commonwealth countries. These are the places where mediation has really taken root. It may say less about the common law system than it does our shared culture and perceived needs. I think that over time, there will be a natural growth of mediation. But then the question becomes, how will mediation evolve in countries where the rule of law may not have as long and strong a history? And I could give examples of that, but clearly that's one issue. Another, frankly, is that there are different conceptions of what mediation is mm-hmm. and what mediators do. In very hierarchical societies, which may include countries in the Persian Gulf, there may be a sense that a mediator should play more of an authoritarian role, that is, actually speaking to the parties on behalf of the community or sources of authority. Just like a judge would or a community leader to say, well, here are options for resolution of this conflict, but you really need to get it resolved. So all of these were issues that we very, very briefly talked about in Doha, but they will all play a part in the evolution of mediation and arbitration in the Gulf.
Thank you. Dean Starr, as you survey the legal landscape and based on your participation in the conference, you've already touched on some of these things. But what do you see as the threats or challenges to the rule of law?
The arbitrary exercise of power. Justice Frankfurter well expressed it, that the history of human liberty is in no small part the history of procedure. and for individuals to be willing and governmental entities to be willing to be constrained by procedure, by process. Sometimes we find process burdensome, tiresome, and we always are eager to find thoughtful ways of improving and reforming procedures. But the failure to control power is really at the heart of the quest for rule of law. The second is closely related, and that is integrity in government, honor and integrity. We see daily reports in the press and in the internet of struggles by so many countries, and even sometimes right here in the United States, to maintain honor and integrity in the conduct of public office. The Supreme Court of the United States has handed down a decision, a deeply divided decision, going to the issues of the appearance of integrity in judicial decision-making. I would say, Dean Perrin, those are two very obvious threats, enforceable procedures. And we've had our own experience here in the United States. Famously, in an impeachable act, President Andrew Jackson said, Chief Justice Marshall has issued his opinion, now let him enforce it. Mm-hmm. And we therefore know that obedience to the rule of law, that's part of the procedure and process that I'm trying to articulate, then coupled with lack of fidelity to the norms of ethics and honor to which all persons of goodwill should aspire.
Professor Stepanowicz, looking back, reflecting on your experience at the conference, what are the takeaways for you? What are you going to remember, and what do you think the conference accomplished, if anything?
I have to say that bringing those hundreds of people from courts, from law firms, all over the world to Doha, Qatar, in itself was a tremendous symbol of change and possibilities for the future. You know, Doha is a city in the desert that literally sprang from the desert floor over a very few short years. It's truly a miracle of its own kind. I think that the fact that all of those people were brought together, and also that there were very, very important subjects of conversation, not only talking about these fundamental principles that Dean Starr was referring to, but that there was a two-hour session in the heart of the conference on the role of women in the law. And Dean Starr also alluded to the role that women play in the local society. But I have to believe that at a time when women in Qatar and many other countries are for the first time really testing their wings in educational programs and in the professional world, the judicial world, and governmental roles, conferences like this one play a very, very important part in heightening consciousness, in encouraging debate, in really challenging popular cultural notions. And so I have to say that those are primary takeaways. I think we are in the midst of all kinds of change globally, at different rates and in different ways. But in its own way, Qatar is a microcosm of several of those changes.
One more question. I'll offer this to both of you as perhaps a concluding word. I'm wondering what Pepperdine University School of Law can or should be doing to extend commitment to the rule of law. What are some things we can do here to effectuate the ends of the conference?
Well, I think our three institutes and centers are already carrying the banner proudly, literally around the world, led by our oldest and most distinguished center, our Strauss Institute for Dispute Resolution. And we're so proud of the work that Tom Stepanowicz and Peter Robinson and the very able colleagues at truly the world-renowned Strauss Institute are able to carry on and to live out the biblical admonition of peacemaking and reconciliation and bringing that very powerful message, but with the skills to achieve these enduring and eternal values or to my mind, invaluable. And if anything, Strauss, which went global before global was cool, is even more a global in its reach. So I'm very eager to see Strauss continue in what was already underway, but under the joint leadership of Tom Stepanovich and Peter Robinson, that footprint is deeper and wider. Secondly, our Nootbaar Institute of Law, Religion, and Ethics has, as its name suggests, living a life greatly and for, again, enduring values. And under the umbrella of Nootbaar is our Global Justice Program, which both brings people from time to time to conferences here at Pepperdine University School of Law, but also, perhaps even more importantly, sends both our faculty and, with all due respect to my faculty colleagues, even more importantly, our students out into the world. First of all, we have more students than faculty members, and we're thankful for that. And the fact that our students are literally around the globe, in sub-Saharan Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, in the places, also in Eastern Europe, is, I think, a source of inspiration to the entire university community as we, I think, thoughtfully, again, through the Nootbaar Institute and its leadership, Bob Cochran, and then the day-to-day director of our Global Justice Program, Jay Milbrandt, find partnerships, including now our partnership with Saddleback Church in Orange County, and through that partnership, an informal partnership with Rick Warren and his marvelous colleagues in the Justice Task Force, we are now reaching out in a very intentional way to the country of Rwanda. And then third and finally, our Palmer Center for Entrepreneurship and the Law developed a friendship with Dr. Muhammad Yunus from Bangladesh, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize 2 years ago, for his path-breaking work as a PhD, an economics professor. It does show that economics professors can not only do great theoretical work, but they can also help change the world through microfinance. And we are frequently keen on the idea of teach a person how to fish as opposed to handing a fish. There's nothing wrong with giving someone a fish, but isn't it all the better to teach the person how to fish so he or she can make his or her own way? And Palmer's focus on social entrepreneurship, I think, is really at the vanguard of what law schools in this country and abroad can do in bringing legal skills to bear, but also entrepreneurial skills directed at serving some of the most needy people on the planet.
Thank you, Dean Starr. Professor Stepanovich, I'm going to give you the last word.
My goodness. Well, I was honored to have an opportunity to accompany Dean Starr and Mrs. Starr on this trip. I think we demonstrated that we truly are marathon runners, spending a little less than 72 hours in the Persian Gulf and then coming back. But I have to say that these kinds of opportunities are among the most exciting for all of us. There is a world of need out there, and we can be involved on so many different levels. And I'm happy that I'm part of an institution where we really approach issues like the rule of law, and frankly, the needs of human society on such a holistic level, because we do not simply focus on the lawyer or the legal client. We really look at human beings in the totality of their existence, and that's really what this conference was all about and really what our programs are about.
Well, thank you both so much for participating in this conversation.
Thank you, Dean Perrin.
Thanks again.